I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. Speaking today with Brian Clegg. He is a science writer and writer of many, many things. He's written about a dozen books about science and about two dozen books about other topics, including creativity and management and all kinds of things. One of his most recent books, which will be of great interest to the listeners to Change Surfer Radio, was Upgrade Me, Our Amazing Journey to Human 2.0. He's also working on an online game, Xenostorm, which I hope you'll tell us a little bit about. And we're talking to him today about his book, Armageddon Science. But before we launch into that, just tell us a little bit about Xenostorm. It seems, was it inspired at all by the Armageddon topic? Because you're having people try to stop Armageddon.
No, it was a pure coincidence. It's an idea I've been playing around with for a young adult novel. And I thought one of the ways just to play around with some ideas was to put it together in a game form. And it's really just something for fun, but I'm enjoying it.
How did you come across the topic of Armageddon? You've written about theoretical physics and some topics which touch on this, but what was the inspiration for this book?
I think the first thing was really the fuss about the Large Hadron Collider, collider in Switzerland, that there was some worry about when it started off that it might somehow end the world. So that was coming really out of my sort of particle physics interest, finding out more about that. And that just started me thinking about all the different ways, you know, that we've suggested that people could end the world, but also the way we regard scientists, whether we still think of the mad scientist kind of idea, the person who wants to rule the world or destroy the world, whether there really are something that people imagine scientists are really like that.
You examined the possibility that the LHC might unleash naked black holes that consume the planet or reset the universe somehow, and you more or less dismiss them as most observers have.
Yeah.
But you think theoretical physics might have some risks that, you know, you describe the theoretical physicist as basically smashing things together and seeing what happens. So are there other science experiments in the theoretical physics area that you are worried about?
Well, the other thing about particle physics really is it is this very childish approach. I mean, I don't mean that in a negative sense. It's just literally, rather than carefully examining something, it's less, let's bang things together as hard as we can and see what happens. Now, on the whole, I think we're reasonably comfortable that we're not going to end the universe that way, because there are bigger explosions, bigger collisions happening out there in the universe all the time. They're just not under our control. So in that sense, I'm not really worried about something like the LHC ending the world. I think, to be honest, it's more down to the conventional things, the atomic bombs, the biological weapons and things like that we have more to worry about than the particle physics.
For the nukes area, are you more concerned about conventional nuclear warfare or about uncontrolled nuclear terrorism?
Well, I'm sort of of an age that I was around during the Cold War, or at least part of it. And, you know, when I was young, I was genuinely worried about conventional nuclear war. It seemed a very real possibility at various stages, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, when I was sort of more conscious of these things. These days, I guess what we tend to be more worried about is terrorism, but we have obviously to be aware of, you know, countries like Iran and North Korea, which potentially could present a threat with conventional weapons. I don't know whether you class them as terrorists or not.
Well, the WikiLeaks exposure this week showed that, in fact, Iran and North Korea have been collaborating on their nuclear weapons program. How seriously do you take those two countries? As I mean, obviously they don't possess very many weapons and nothing comparable to the United States, Russia, probably China. But the proliferation from those kinds of countries could be quite a threat, couldn't it?
I think that is absolutely the case, especially when you have a country like North Korea, where the those in charge, shall we say, don't behave particularly rationally. The last people that you want in charge of nuclear weapons, but it is a very difficult situation. You can't just walk in there and sort it out. You know, we know from the experience of Iraq that it's not an easy thing to do, to go and sort out another country. I don't have easy answers to this. It's something we have to be aware of. And I guess part of my message is that I would like more people to understand what the science is, what the risks are, so that they can approach these things more sensibly and more rationally, rather than just knowing that there's something horrible out there and we don't know what to do about it.
This is the overall theme, and the upshot of your book is that you think that there's too much irrational fear about the wrong targets and a lack of scientific accountability for some of the legitimate targets, and you're calling for more scientific literacy in general.
Yes, I think so. I mean, we live in a world where science plays a major part in our everyday lives. You know, practically everything we do, whether it's talking as I am now to you from several thousand miles away, using the internet, going in a plane, whatever. Technology, science is all around us, but frankly, most of us haven't a very good grasp of what's going on, and we expect our politicians to make decisions. But again, those politicians often don't know an awful lot about science. And I genuinely believe we could do with better science education really across the board so that we can make better decisions about science and how it affects our lives.
I participated a couple years ago in a seminar at Oxford on global catastrophic risks, and they brought together folks talking about a lot of the topics that you talk about in this book. And one of the things that I came away from that was that scientists themselves exist in such huge unknowns. So, you know, even something as apparently quantifiable as how many asteroids there are that could whack us, there are apparently some debates about whether we can see all the asteroids that might be able to whack us. Some of them might be made of materials that are, you know, invisible to us right now. And of course, when you get into areas like bioterrorism, it becomes even more unquantifiable. And so I guess I'm a little cautious about the notion that increasing scientific literacy in the public is going to have much effect, because it might just introduce them to unquantifiable scientific risks that they hadn't known about before, but which are equally, you know, implausible or unquantifiable.
No, I can see that. It's a misbelief that science is really something that provides you with 100% of the truth. It's our best information at the moment. It will change. We can't get everything right. But even so, I think when you look at the way people worry, if you think of the sort of nuclear risk, what happened after Three Mile Island and that kind of thing, where, you know, what was actually in the end a relatively small, relatively controlled situation. There was an awful lot of panic about it, understandably, because people really didn't understand what was going on. And I think sometimes it is still helpful. You know, there are aspects of this risk we can't quantify, but there's an awful lot we do know a lot more about than the general public typically does, and they are still expecting their politicians to make decisions about these things really without enough information, I'd suggest.
Nick Bostrom over at Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford, he has made the distinction between catastrophic risks, which could kill a lot of people, but not necessarily wipe us out, and existential risks. And you're talking about both in this book.
Yeah.
He would make the distinction between climate change being a catastrophic risk in that it may kill a billion people or something, but wouldn't necessarily end civilization as we know it. But there seem to be a couple unknowns in the climate area, and you mentioned one of them in your book, the methane feedback loop. And I just wonder, you know, if you could expand on, you know, whether you see climate change as something that could seriously degrade civilization instead of just moving population around or forcing us to eat different foods.
I have no doubt that there is a risk it could have a very significant effect. I mean, as you say, it's very unlikely climate change is going to wipe out humanity entirely. But I do think when you get up to maybe 4 or 5 degrees Celsius, so sort of 8, 9, 10 degrees Fahrenheit change, if you're getting to that sort of level, I believe that there would be sufficient impact really in things like sea level rise, in areas of drought, forest fires, all kinds of things that would make us have a sufficiently large impact that it would actually mean our civilization was on the edge. I'm not going to say everything is going to fall apart entirely, but I think it has the potential to be a very serious situation. But the fact is, I think realistically, knowing human beings, knowing the way we are, we aren't going to do that much about it until things get quite a lot worse. It's very easy, especially when you've got a time of financial difficulties like we all have at the moment, to say, okay, yeah, it is important, but we'll put it to one side and worry about it when we've got the money. But the climate change isn't waiting for us.
One of the unknowns there is kind of how fragile civilization is, whether or the level of complexity that we've reached would, you know, if we had a serious shock to the system, whether it would start to unravel. And you addressed that a little bit with the information meltdown. But is this, you know, part of your anxiety as well, looking at, you know, a number of these threats? If we had maybe not a civilization-ending asteroid, but an asteroid and a little bit of climate change and a little bit of bioterrorism, you know, could it all start unraveling?
I think that, to be honest, I'm not trying to be sort of scaremongering, but yes, I think that is a potential to happen. I mean, if you look at the asteroids, obviously we're looking at a fairly low probability. It's the same with something like a supervolcano that would, you know, have a major impact on both climate and probably taking out a fairly large part of whatever country it's in. So that, you know, that there are things that could have these major impacts. As you say, if you bring more than one of them together, I think it's not unreasonable to say that you could say could see a total shift in civilization as we now know it. On the whole, personally, I'm optimistic. You know, I think we will get around things, we will get over things, we will manage. But I just think we need to be aware of what's out there and what's possible.
For some of these risks, like climate change and asteroids, we have ways of monitoring what's happening and predicting and then even mitigating the risk. So with asteroids, there are various proposals for how we might deflect them or, you know, get them to go someplace else. But there's a couple that some of the natural risks that there aren't any mitigation strategies for. Supervolcanoes is one. I just wonder if that's the one that really, of the natural risks, that really keeps me up at night. Because the last time the Yellowstone supervolcano went off, it covered half the United States in 3 feet of ash. And so that amount of ash in the sky would probably kill almost all agriculture on the planet for a couple of years.
I think there is no doubt, you know, that we're looking at something there that would be devastating if it happened in the continental United States. Again, as you say, it would pretty well be the end for the US. The good thing, I guess, is that we are talking about something that statistically is relatively unlikely to happen in any particular lifetime. So, I mean, in a sense, worrying too much about it is, you know, it's a bit like worrying about being in a plane crash. They do happen. They are terrible if you're involved in it, but actually it's very unlikely it's going to happen to you. And as such, when there's absolutely nothing you can do about it, because literally there's absolutely nothing we could do about a supervolcano, I think you're really at the stage of saying, okay, well, it is frightening. It's interesting to know about, but I'm going to put it at the back of my mind because there's just nothing I can do about it.
Now, you have written a book about human enhancement, and so you get into some of the more futuristic scenarios, and you talk about nanorobotics and nanotechnology, artificial intelligence, the singularity. You seem skeptical about some of these things. One of the things you're skeptical about is you're not sure that there actually is technological acceleration. Can you just elaborate on that?
Well, the idea of the singularity depends really on the idea that everything is getting faster and faster, that there's exponential growth in the capabilities of technology. And the thing that makes me slightly doubtful of that is if you look at one of the common examples given for that, it's the speed at which we travel. And the enthusiasts for this approach will tell you, well, you know, we used to be able to just go 3 or 4 miles an hour. And then towards the end of the 19th century, we got trains. So we could go on the railroad maybe 50 miles an hour, 60 miles an hour. And then this century, we had planes, so suddenly we could get to 200. And even quicker, we had spacecraft, so we were going thousands of miles an hour. And you look at this and you say, wow, that's amazing. But then you have to take a step back and say, well, if you're thinking about the general population, they never got as far as the spacecraft, so the airplane is the fastest thing they've ever been in. And if you look specifically at that, in the 1970s, we had Concorde come along, and people could go at twice the speed of sound. Now, the fastest you're going to go is 500, 600 miles an hour, and that's it. We've actually gone backwards. So you can't assume that everything is going to continue the way it has up till now. Again, if you're looking at technology, there's this Moore's Law idea that computer processors, will double in capability every year and a half or so. And certainly that has happened pretty steadily to date. But you can't predict necessarily that's going to happen for too long because we're just running out of the space to get those computer chips smaller and smaller, to get the circuitry smaller and smaller. We're getting down to the size where atoms are going to start saying, you can't go any smaller than this. So I'm just a little bit doubtful when people predict off into the future and say, yes, it's going to carry on with exponential growth as far as you can imagine.
I'm also critical of the singularity idea, but more because I think that they are over-focused on the possibilities, the catastrophic possibilities of mad scientists, and less on weirdness. And I give you an example that, we have this Iran worm, this worm that was targeted at Iranian components of building the nuclear, the uranium, refining uranium in Iran. And we have other kinds of worms that have been targeted at building bots that can collect passwords and so forth around the world. If those kinds of worms and viruses begin to mutate or change in any way, or were released maliciously, in more and more complex forms, you could imagine a kind of bottom-up catastrophic information singularity as opposed to an AI jumping out of a box that was being designed to be a super intelligent being. And, we can be annoyed. We can have all our cake eaten by cyber rats as easily as, be conquered by a cyber god. So I guess this goes back to the complexity problem, that the information meltdown problem, that I think the singularity folks are over-focused on, how their super brains might build another super brain as opposed to just the weirdness.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. The good news, I guess, is if it is literally just a case of some sort of virus or worm that's mutated or some way gets more powerful, at least we have ways around that. We can attack back. We can, if all else fails, shut everything down and restart it. So we've got a little bit more historical experience. There have been worms around as long as the internet's been around, well, before the internet. In a sense, I think I'm less worried about that. In the long term, I think it may cause occasional problems. It will cause occasional problems, but I don't think it's going to change the world.
One of the cognitive biases that people bring to consideration of catastrophic risks is the kind of religious, apocalyptic, and millennial expectations that they have about the future. And I'm sure that this was, you know, a background of something that you were looking at as well. There's a lot of people who will take your book and say, look, you know, everything I expect about the second coming is coming true. How much, I mean, your call is for more scientific literacy. Is the flip side of that less millennialist and apocalyptic cognitive bias?
I suppose, I mean, personally, coming from a culture where there is less of that, it's probably less common in Europe than it is in the United States. It's not something I'd honestly considered significantly when I was thinking about this. And when you say it, I guess, yes, I think I am. It's not, I'm not in any sense attacking religion or people's beliefs. But if you come to the stage of saying, you know, this is the end times, we might as well just give up. I think you're taking the wrong approach with your religious belief.
Yeah, fatalism that might come out of that. Now, another aspect of the fatalism is the singularitarians, like Kurzweil, argue vociferously that there's very little that governments could do to stop the emergence of whatever they expect, you know, super AIs or enhanced humans. They believe that it will all go out of control, and they hope for the best. You seem to be much more sanguine about the possibility of control.
I think, as with all these things, you know, science isn't absolute, our technological knowledge isn't absolute, but from my viewpoint, I would suggest that, you know, we are reasonably good at controlling technology. We don't expect, we might expect our computers, say, or our cars to go wrong, but on the whole, we can control that. And I know that the people who believe in the singularity will say it'll get to the point where we can't control it. But it starts feeling to me just a bit too much like science fiction when something says, you know, you can't switch me off. I'm not totally convinced that we would let things get to that stage. We are pretty good at building in safeguards. We are pretty good at thinking these things through.
Of course, Ray Kurzweil would say that the nature of an exponential trend is that you have almost nothing until a day or two before you have it all on the table. And so that, you know, it could come upon us quite quickly. You know, superintelligence might bootstrap itself into existence quite quickly.
No, I could see that argument. I mean, as I mentioned, some aspects of the exponential trends I'm a little dubious about. But I would also say that it's something that I personally just don't feel that it's an area that we should be worrying so much about as the more conventional problems, you know, back to the nuclear weapons, the biohazards, climate change. I think, frankly, are much more likely to be serious problems for us. Yes, it is vaguely possible that something amazing could come out of information technology that will somehow threaten us. But I think it's much more likely to come from one of the more conventional routes. And in the end, you have to balance up the probabilities and go with the things that you think are most likely to cause damage. I mean, it's the same with the nanobots. You know, it's a lovely idea. It makes good fiction. But if you look at the actual difficulties of producing a robot on the scale, such a tiny scale, it's something that's so far beyond our capabilities, I'm very doubtful that it's going to be an issue, certainly in my lifetime.
There seemed to be one category that you left out of these catastrophes, and maybe because it's even more speculative than these, more speculative than a Terminator scenario, and that's the kind of slow drift of humanity using enhancement or genetic engineering or neurotechnology towards something that we wouldn't recognize and appreciate anymore as being our descendants. Is this something that, I know that in Upgrade Me, you are reasonably positive and optimistic about our ability to navigate that course, but has this something that you consciously put off the table?
No, not really. I mean, I did mention it briefly in this book. It was partly that I just didn't want to cover too much of the same ground as I had in Upgrade Me. I guess what my attitude has always been that it's a mistake to think that enhancing ourselves is something new. in Upgrade Me, I sort of talked about how, you know, even things like using a dog, using a stone axe, all the sort of very basic stuff was a form of upgrade. The fact that it wasn't actually physically built into our bodies really is almost an aside. That it's our natural, one of our natural characteristics is to change the way we interact with our environment to effectively upgrade ourselves. And I honestly think that in terms of the sort of invasive upgrades, so the idea of putting more and more technology actually inside of our body, I think that could be a dead end. I think on the whole, my suspicion is that people are going to be sufficiently doubtful about having lots of technology put in their body, that we would rather tend to see ways of interacting with technology, using our minds, that doesn't require physical intrusion. So I think actually the sort of cyborg idea, the idea of something half human, half mechanical or whatever, is actually not pretty unlikely to happen.
Well, this has been great. What are you working on next?
I'm just finishing a book that'll be coming out, I think, towards the end of next year, which is called How to Build a Time Machine.
Sweet.
So it's looking at the science of time travel, because there's nothing in physics that actually prevents time travel. In fact, there are some quite good examples where we know it in a small scale, it does actually happen. So it's a bit of fun. It's certainly rather different in feel than thinking about Armageddon.
And hopefully the two aren't connected, although I know scenarios where they are. But we'll definitely have you back to talk about that one. I've been speaking with Brian Clegg. You can find him at briancleg.net and briancleg.blogspot.com. And we've been talking about his book, Armageddon Science, The Science of Mass Destruction. And you can also check out Upgrade Me, Our Amazing Journey to Human 2.0. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to archive.org. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.